Welcome to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. I'm Stephen Spitz. We all know that New Mexico has a terrible problem with child abuse and neglect. We're also last in the nation in child well-being, with high percentages of impoverished children living in single families. But children are resilient, aren't they? Not so fast, says our guest, Dr. Bruce Perry, both a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist whose writing and work is all about the effect of stress and trauma on early brain development. Dr. Perry has been the featured speaker at many, many venues, from Oprah to a recent firstborn conference in New Mexico. Dr. Bruce Perry, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much. I appreciate the opportunity.
Dr. Perry, what I'd like to do is start with a case history from your best-selling book, The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog, then talk to you briefly about the so-called ACEs study. And if listeners don't know what the ACEs study is, you've got to stay tuned. And then finally talk to you about the what you say is the deleterious effect on brain development of smaller and smaller families raising children. So let's start with a case history from your book. What I'd like to talk to you about is the case history of Laura, who was a seriously underweight four-year-old who, when you came to visit her, had a stack of medical files that was actually taller than she was. So can you tell us about Laura?
Laura was a young girl who was in the hospital at the time I first met her. She had been well known to the healthcare system for many years, actually since she was born. Let me just back up for a second and tell you the story about her mom. Her mother was raised in the child welfare system, and she was had an unfortunate start. She was abused and neglected and then removed from her biological parents and then placed with a foster family. And the foster family was actually very supportive and very good. However, because Laura's mother, early in life, had never really received attentive, attuned caring, certain fundamental capabilities around physical touch, nurturing, and getting reward and regulation from those relational interactions just never really developed fully in her.
You know, what I found really fascinating in your book was that, you know, they apparently this foster system used to move children when Virginia was a child every 6 months so they wouldn't attach. And, of course, attachment is one of the key things that we try and that we realize now that we need to get with kids.
Exactly.
So
it was you know, it was a policy that was well-intended, but it was very, very destructive. So what happened was these children were moved every 3 months, every 4 months, every 6 months, so that they didn't get too connected to whoever was caring for them. And it's an interesting thing. The parts of our brain that are involved in forming and maintaining relationships, the parts of our brain that allow us to love and to be empathic, grow in what we call a use-dependent way, very much like the part of our brain involved in language. So if you think, for example, about a child who's growing up in an environment where they hear English for 4 months, and then they never hear English again, and then they hear Spanish for 5 months, and then they never hear Spanish, and they just hear German. You know, if they had exposure to 10 sequential languages, by the time they're 3 years old, they wouldn't speak any language. And it's not like any one of those languages are bad. It's just that they never had sufficient repetitions with any one language required to build in the fundamental characteristics of language. And it's the same thing with the language of love, basically.
That's the part that's hard to grasp for a layman, I guess.
Yeah, I think it is. I think, but again, if you just step back and think about how we learn language, you know, the number of your specific your language capabilities is related to the number of words spoken to you in conversational interactions. But in order to develop the fundamental biology in your brain, you know, to make those synaptic connections that allow you to speak language, you have to have sufficient repetitions. And so if you keep moving a person from a household that speaks one language and then another language and then another language and then another language, the specific sounds created by any one language are not going to be sufficient to create those fundamental associations and connections. So the mother of Laura, Virginia, grew up with this underdeveloped capacity for nurturing. And so when she got pregnant at a young age and had a baby, she just didn't understand and didn't feel the pull to be nurturing and loving in the way that lots of us think is natural. You know, people talk about it all the time that, well, you know, mothers will have a baby and they just naturally will love their baby. But that's not true. That if you have not been loved in a very nurturing way, if you haven't been rocked, if you haven't been held as an infant and a young child, you won't be pulled to do that because your brain never made the connection between feeding and nurturing, between nurturing touch and eye contact and all the positive things that go with those early infant interactions. Your brain just never made those connections. So you won't be pulled to do that.
So you were called in because the prior diagnosis by another psychiatrist had been that this was the first known case is infantile anorexia. And right. You somehow come up with, you determine that it's none of these very sophisticated medical issues that have been elaborately pursued with Laura, but it's this basic lack of a relationship with her mother that's causing her to be so underweight and not to thrive. So that, in some ways, this is quite remarkable on your part that, you know, you see through all this.
Well, you're giving me a little bit too much credit. I mean, the fact is I knew that right away because I'd actually studied the similar phenomenon in animals.
I see.
And, you know, many people, if you've ever been on a farm, people know that if you have a litter of animals, mammal mother would do it. It could be a cat or a rat or a dog. All mammals do this, that when their little pup is at their teat, they will nuzzle them and nurture them and lick the back of their neck, and they'll give them these somatosensory, these physical signals that say you're loved, basically. But if you're the runt, they literally push you away from the teat, and your body doesn't get those signals. And so when your body doesn't get those signals, it literally tells itself to shut down and to stop. Humans have that same equivalent. We have that same biological capability to shut down our physiology. When we get the signals from our primary caregiver, from our mother, that we're not wanted or that we're a burden to the family.
So the absence of love and the absence of nurturing actually causes this, I guess, the lack of a growth hormone so that
right.
This underweight baby stays underweight and doesn't absorb. I guess the baby was being fed by a feeding tube and had a high calorie diet, but wouldn't gain weight. And
exactly.
And I guess here I think you do deserve some credit. So what you end up really prescribing is that this child needs a lot of love, and Virginia needs to be shown how to be loving as a mother.
Right, right. I mean, I have to say, I'm glad you picked this as a vignette because it's one of my favorite clinical interventions because it wasn't punitive to this mother. You know, we weren't saying to her, you're a bad person, but she had never been literally taught these things and had never been loved in a way that would allow these capabilities to emerge. So we took this young child and the mother and put them both in a household where there was a very loving grandmotherly figure who was very physical. She would rock the baby all day long. And she, even though the child, you know, was four, she treated the child like an infant. And she was also very loving and touching and used healthy physical touch with the mother. And so they both developed together. And it turned out to be a very nice outcome. They both ended up doing very well.
So I want to move on to the ACEs study, which really sort of looks more comprehensively at the effects of neglect and abuse on adult behavior. But before I do that, let me just mention this. This is New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm thrilled to have on the phone Dr. Bruce Perry, who's a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist. He's been all over the country talking to all kinds of people, Oprah, the Firstborn Conference here in New Mexico. And I guess it's still sort of hard to grasp a little bit how, you know, the absence of love, the absence of touching, neglect can affect physical health in people. We can understand how it can affect mental health, but affecting physical health is harder to grasp. And if people don't know about the ACEs study, that really is all about it. And I know you've written about it, and I wonder if you can just describe it briefly for us and what it showed.
The ACEs studies were and still are a large epidemiological project looking at initially about 17,000 adults. And they looked at many aspects of their functioning, including their physical health. And they also retrospectively looked at what are called adverse childhood experiences. And so these adverse childhood experiences could be any variety of things. Things like exposure to domestic violence, having a parent who went to prison, having significant traumatic event take place, like sexual abuse, physical abuse, and so forth. And it turns out that the functioning of your heart, your risk for heart disease, the functioning of your pancreas, your risk for diabetes, the functioning of your lungs, your risk for asthma. And you could go down the line of any organ in your body. And basically, your risk for having a problem with one of those organs is going to be increased between 3 and 12 times by virtue of having had high adverse childhood experiences. And so initially, you know, the idea that developmental trauma would increase your risk for heart disease as much as smoking cigarettes was something that people were just shocked by.
I remember when I first heard about this study, I was stunned, absolutely stunned
right.
by it.
Right. And again, being a neuroscientist, I understand a little bit about what goes on in the body and a little bit about how the brain and body work together. And so earlier you mentioned that it's sort of hard to think about how experiences influence the physiology of the body. But in fact, you know, every time you see something, every time you hear something, every time you smell something, that is essentially physical energy that's turned into patterned, repetitive neuronal activity by your senses. So your eyes and your ears and your skin and everything that helps you make sense out of the world, all your senses turn energy into neuronal activity. That neuronal activity then goes into your brain and influences your, not just the way you think and perceive things, but it influences the systems in your brain that are involved in sending hormones out to your body, the systems in your brain that send direct nerve connections to all parts of your body, what we call the autonomic nervous system. And then the systems that are involved in how the brain influences your immune system. So when the systems in your brain involved in processing threat-related information or stress-related information become overactive and overly reactive, then all of these physiological systems that are influenced by the brain start to also get overworked. So if you have any underlying genetic vulnerability in the way your muscles or bones or heart or pancreas are put together, this additional load of stress will influence how those systems work. So the interesting thing about this is that you and I might have the exact same score of adversity from early childhood, but we'll have different physiological problems that are connected to it because I may have the genetics that makes me vulnerable for diabetes, and you might have the genetics that makes you vulnerable for arthritis.
I see. Now, are there critical periods? Now, I think I've seen in your writing that somehow 0 to 3 years, or prenatal really to 3 years, is the key period, but that even more important, the first 3 months of life is really important.
Well, you know, these are areas of really active investigation. And there's just, in general, here's what we know. The brain is more rapidly organizing and changing in utero and in the first few years of life than any other time. And because of that, it tends to be much more sensitive to experiences, both good experiences and bad experiences. So, you know, that's not the end of the story. There are other times in life when the brain goes through these rapid transformations. One of those is in adolescence. So there are certain periods in life when your brain is, if you will, more malleable. It's more sensitive to experience. And so early developmental trauma in the first years of life, first couple years of life, will end up having much more significant and enduring problems than the same experience that takes place when you're 12. And again, both adversity at both times in life can have consequences, but the severity of the consequences tend to be worse early in life.
All right, so this is New Mexico, People, Places, and Ideas. My name is Stephen Spitz, and I'm very pleased to have on the phone from the Child Trauma Center, is that right? You are the director of the Child Trauma Center in Houston, Dr. Bruce Perry. And Dr. Perry is both a psychiatrist and a neuroscientist. And I'd like to move to a third area and then hopefully tie it all up at the end. And the third area is something I've heard you talk about, which is that we have a problem with in terms of what we wish for. We all sort of wish to have our own place. We wish to have our own family. And so what we've ended up with are smaller and smaller families raising children. And this is sort of, be careful what you wish for because it may not be good. You're very concerned about the effect on brain development of these smaller families raising children, are you not?
Well, what I'm concerned about is that our culture broadly, with the introduction of technology, with the change in the demographics of the family, with the increase in mobility of society, all of these things are essentially decreasing the amount of relational time that we have with each other. And because human beings are such relational creatures, there are fundamental physiological benefits that come from being around other people, from conversation, from laughter, from touch. And we are now spending about 1/20th the amount of direct human interactive time in the modern world compared to the way we lived 100 years ago. And again, my concern is that these parts of our brain that are involved in empathy, parts of the brain involved that are also involved in physiological regulation of the stress response and the reward neurobiology, all these really important systems in our brain are relationally dependent. And so if you think about the way human beings live for 99.9% of the time we've been on the planet, we lived in multi-generational, multi-family groups. And for a young child growing up, the ratio of developmentally more mature individuals to that young child was 4 to 1. So there were 4 people that you could watch from who could interact with you, who could nurture you, discipline you. And for you, just for, you know, that ratio is 4 to 1. Now we think it's a great childcare setting when there's 1 caregiver and 6 kids. So that, again, that's 1/24th the relational milieu that our brain is essentially designed for. And I think what we're having is people growing up who are chronologically getting older and older and older, but they're having fewer and fewer relational and social-emotional learning opportunities. So you get 18, 19, 20-year-old people who have the social-emotional maturity of 4, 5, and 6-year-old people. And so this is, there's a number of indications in the way our culture is going that suggest that this is a problem. You know, the disengagement of the youth from voting, from many aspects of civic life, the over-focus and increased selfishness of people, decreases in volunteerism, increases in measures of empathy, increases in measures of sociopathy in general populations. So these are things to be concerned about, and I'm not sure I know exactly how to solve it, but I think we need to have an open debate about this.
It seems like it sort of goes back to what you said about Laura. You know, she needed the cognitive, the emotional, the physical stimulation in order to develop, and it seems to tie in with the ACEs study of, say, severe neglect. And here we have, I don't know, what you might call modest neglect. And I guess is there sort of a continuum? I mean, the name of your book is The Boy Who Was Raised as a Dog. There was a boy who was literally raised as a dog. He suffered from severe neglect. So is there sort of a continuum of the effect of neglect on, you know, from severe neglect to moderate neglect to, you know, on down the line? And is that what we're talking about here in terms of what your concern is? Not enough contact.
I think that captures it very well. You know, many of these extreme cases, like the boy who was raised as a dog, teach us something about the way the brain organizes and works. But if you move from those extreme cases to less severe cases, you start to see similar changes in the brain. They're not as severe, but they're similar. And then you move all the way into sort of the mean, and what you realize is that there are many aspects of the way human beings develop and function that can be profoundly influenced by the fundamental choices we make about child rearing, about how our culture works, about what we value and what we don't value. And the most obvious example for me is that right now in our culture, we very much value reading. So we spend a significant amount of time in the way we spend money and the way our educational system works, teaching parents, read to your child, teaching children, here's your ABCs, helping people learn how to write paragraphs. All of these things, we value that. But 5,000 years ago, we were genetically the same species. There wasn't a single human being on the planet who could read. So we had the potential to do that, but it was never expressed because the broader beliefs and practices of the societies we grew up in did not have a written word. We didn't write, so we never taught anybody to read. So what I'm concerned about is that we currently are making choices that lead to underexpression of our capability to be caring and compassionate and nurturing. And just like learning how to read requires pattern repetitive exposure to the A's and the B's and the C's and practice your writing and practice your sentence writing and practice your paragraph construction, repetition with these cognitive things, we're not getting sufficient repetitions with relational things. And so, you know, we take the average number of hours in front of a screen for the U.S. kid is 11 hours.
11 hours
so
per?
11 hours in front of a screen. It's not just TV, but the total collective screens. You know,
per day?
Video game, TV.
Per day, you're saying?
Per day.
Per day, wow. So we're nearing the end of the show, and I'd sort of like to bring the conversation back to New Mexico in some ways. And you know, we could treat the issues you raise as a public health issue, and they obviously are to some extent a public health issue. They have behavioral and physical characteristics. But, you know, New Mexico is a very poor state, all right? We've got more than 70% of our births are Medicaid qualified. More than 80% of our families qualify for what used to be called food stamps, or now called SNAP. We have a very modest home visiting program. We visit about, out of 28,000 births, we visit about 1,000 families a year. We spend about $8 million on that. If just a back-of-the-envelope calculation by me, if we were to home visit just firstborn kids for 3 years, that would be $50 million a year. So we're $130 million short there. So what do we do? You know, how do we as a state and how do we as a nation sort of try to grapple with the issues that you raise? Because they're obviously legitimate, serious issues, but how do we deal with them?
Yeah, that's a great question. And we actually think about this a lot. And the answer is going to sound a little political, but the answer is that there are multiple things that we can do. Increasing the number of high-quality home visiting programs is certainly worth the investment. People have done bang-for-your-buck assessments or return on investment analysis, and doing home visiting and high-quality early childhood care for at-risk families, it leaves a $7 to $9 return on investment. It's a really smart thing to do. So that's one thing. The other thing is that anything that we do to increase the health of a community, of a family, will decrease these risk factors for young children. So even if there isn't a whole lot of money, things that can be done include helping people in a community build better relationships with each other, facilitate community-based and community-derived programs and activities and Mother Day drop-in models, decrease the isolation of young parents. And a lot of these things are not that expensive. And so anything you do to increase the number and the quality of relational interactions in the life of a young mother and child will address these problems to some degree. But fundamentally, what you're pointing out and what I think is really important is this is going to require more of a movement than a program. This is going to require people to think carefully about cultural values, about what we as a society value, about how what we teach in schools. Is it more important for children to learn how to share versus learning algebra? How do we help children to spend more time with each other, to figure out how to have less screen time, how to have more play in school, spend more relational time with each other, and less time sitting in isolation focused on a cognitive concept?
I'm afraid to say we're out of time. Thanks to my guest, Dr. Bruce Perry, my producer, Jefferson White, my executive producer, Lynn Shebeki. You've been listening to New Mexico People, Places, and Ideas on KUNM. My name is Stephen Spitz. Thanks for listening. See you next time.